dear listeners. Today, I am hosting our Medium podcast Talking Democracy with my wonderful guests, Efim and Marta. We will be discussing the party position change on immigration and the European so-called refugee crisis. For this topic, Efim van der Wulden, our visiting fellow, will provide insights into his current field of study. He is a PhD candidate in political science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. His research focuses on examining the influence of hate and exposure to ethnic diversification at the national level on party positions regarding immigration. Today he will be presenting his current research findings on conflicting and aligning incentives that parties face when confronted with this crucial issue. And also our second guest, Marta Kozłowska, a postdoctoral researcher at MEDA. At MEDM, she studies democratic development in Central and Eastern Europe. Her research centers on political discourse, democratic participation, and the development of political parties. Besides that, she also researches party ideologies and their electoral manifestos. Let us start with the basics. What does it actually mean to turn right? Efim, would you mind giving us a short explanation?
Sure. So thank you for that kind introduction, and it's great to be here. So this project is trying to understand why political parties might shift their issue positions. And specifically, it's looking at the issue of immigration. So just to start us off, I'm interested in why some parties may adopt more rightward or restrictive positions on immigration, while others may kind of adopt more open or leftist positions on immigration. So when I say turning right in this paper, that means parties that will advocate for more closed borders, less refugees, and parties that may engage in some rhetoric that's trying to demonize migrants or refugees. So that, to me, is a rightward turn on the issue of immigration. One small thing that I want to note here is that I'm not actually talking about issue salience, so not the attention that parties might give to issues, but rather their position kind of on a left-right spectrum. So it's not a study about which parties devote the most attention to immigration, but rather which parties might adopt more kind of restrictive language versus which parties might adopt more open language.
Marta, as a specialist on party ideologies, how would you define the so-called right that we and our listeners are on the same page?
Well, actually, trying to define what is right-wing is a million-dollar question. And this is also something that has a huge body in the literature. So there is not a straightforward answer. And if you look on the history of studying political ideologies, it's very often that it's the left that is defined. And the right is more like that is what it is not, which is not a very good way of defining thinking. It is not a very good way to define things. However, if you look at the different types of basically defining the left, and then defining the right as the opposite to that, we can see four main traditional understandings of left-wing and right-wing. The first one is the Marxist one. So this one is based mostly on class conflict and struggle. The right is being defined as the class of the owners, more or less, and it's also the one that is in power. And because they are profiting from the structures, the social structures, we're speaking mostly of 19th century, the classical Marxist time, the right is conservative and is not interested in social change, whereas the left is usually revolutionary and interested in progress or at least in change. So this is the first one. The second one is based on the role of the state in the mostly in the economy, but also in the society. So this is the discussion of the conflict between the small and big government or the laissez-faire or the statist position. So basically, how much of the state in the economy, how many regulations, how many interventions, and so on. So this is the second axis of comparison. Then we also have a conflict on the distribution of wealth or distribution of resources. So here again, we see the left as the one interested in redistributing, and the right is the one that is not that much in favor of that. Let's put it this way. And there is also a fourth way. This is also, I would consider, is already a classic concept, even though it's from the 90s. And it's from Norberto Bobbio, who actually said that the main difference between the left and the right, regardless if it's about the state or the economy or the classes or whatever, it's about the attitudes towards inequality, and not only inequality in the economic sense, but also inequality in sense of different classes, different strata, different positions, rights, and so on. So basically, the left see inequalities as undesirable, and the right thinks it's a natural way of or order of things. Hierarchies are normal or even desired. So these are the four classical understandings. And now you can also ask yourself, okay, where does the populist right or the far right fit into that? So here are two ways we can see that. One is unidimensional and the second one is two-dimensional. And the first one is basically we see the political spectrum as a spectrum. So we see the right from the center right towards Christian democratic, conservative, national democratic or liberal democratic before that a little bit. And then we move farther to the right and we see the far right, the extreme right and so on. So this is one way of looking at the things. So I would say here the definition of Kasmuda, how to differentiate extreme right parties and far right parties from other parties. Basically, what Muda says is we need three elements for a party to be far-right party. First is the nativist element, which is the central one. Then we have authoritarian attitudes and populist. And then if we have a fourth element, which is anti-democratic or anti-state elements, then we have an extreme far-right party. The two-dimensional one, which is also a huge body of research on itself. So very shortly, what we see is we see like two dimensions, the vertical and horizontal line of like two spectrums intercutting. The first one is the classic left-wing, right-wing in economic sense. And then we have a vertical line, which is usually described as the new politics or new left, new right. And this one is more about attitudes. And in this atoms, the classic economic axis will be more for the traditional right-wing parties or the conservatives and so on, and the populist rights will be on the second vertical that is related to values.
Ethan, you said that migration has caused a party position change. In your working paper, you mentioned that political parties tend to shift towards restrictive immigration positions with higher levels of asylum claims. Could you please explain why?
Yeah, so thank you for that introduction of this project. So the question is, why would political parties adopt more restrictive positions on immigration in places with more asylum claims? So I want to just point out a few things that I find in my paper, which is that it's not actually that all political parties are more likely to adopt restrictive positions on immigration as a function of asylum claims, but rather this relationship really only holds for center-right parties. So in the data that I'm looking at, I find that center-right parties are more likely to adopt kind of rightward restrictive positions on immigration in countries with higher levels of asylum claims. That is what the data is telling me. I want to point out a few things there, though. The first is that if we look at the overall shifts in migration positions throughout the refugee crisis, we actually don't see much change. So looking at party positions before the crisis and after the crisis, the average movement for a party is actually quite close to zero, which I think is an interesting finding in and of itself, right? Political parties throughout this period did not seem to move right or left. Now, what I'm trying to do in this paper, though, is explain the variation that we see in parties, which is to say, although the average movement is very close to zero, some parties move to the right and some parties move to the left. To explain that variation, I try to look at, does the amount of asylum claims in a country kind of predict which parties might move right, which parties might move left? When we try to like understand why I find what I do, I argue in this paper that it's really important to consider the incentives that different political parties face when kind of confronting a high salience issue. So I argue that in places where we have more asylum claims, parties are kind of pressured to clarify the statements that they make on immigration and are pressured to potentially adopt new positions. And then to kind of understand why we really only see rightward shifts for center-right parties, whereas other parties, we don't see that same pattern. I think about like what electoral incentives do parties have to change their positions? And a lot of data is out there that kind of shows that with increasing levels of migration, voter attitudes can polarize. So we get more people kind of adopting extreme right positions, more people adopting extreme left positions. Center-right parties, I argue, are kind of incentivized to try to move to the right to keep like some of these voters, as well as ward off competition from far-right parties. Importantly, this strategy may not work. So it is like what I'm trying to argue in this paper is that there is incentives there. It's not necessarily that any particular strategy will work, but it is for center-right parties, like the incentive aligns towards moving to the right when faced with this high salience issue.
Thank you very much for your explanation about your topic. I'm looking forward to read your paper when it's finished. But Marta, as an expert on Central Eastern Europe, do you think the Central Eastern Europe cases mostly fit this overall pattern, or do you see any diversions?
I would say that the general pattern is also the same in Central Eastern Europe. Of course, I haven't seen the data specifically. So as the German saying goes, never trust data that you haven't falsified by yourself. So what I'm doing right now is more or less applying what you have found to what I already know or just making some educated guesses. I would say the pattern fits. We see something like that more or less too. However, like my main concern is because what you're measuring is basically the number of asylum seekers influencing the changes in party positions. And the problem is, especially in the so-called Euro crisis of 2015-16, is the countries in the region did not take any, with the exception of Hungary, but mostly as a transit country, Czechia, Slovakia, Poland, but also other countries of the eastern flank of the European Union did not take in any refugees. So in this sense, we should expect zero changes. However, what has changed was the political discourse. So the silence of the issue skyrocketed from mostly non-existent because most of the countries did not have many asylum seekers or refugees or any immigrants worth mentioning for that matter either, which means the issue was not really part of the political discussions. And suddenly it became the issue, even though the people, the migrants, the asylum seekers themselves never came. But they became central. And my question is, would we see the same results if the people came, or would we see more of that? So basically, what is actually causing the change here? Is it the people actually coming, or isn't the talking about them coming?
Thank you very much for your statement, Marta. Now we know that Central Eastern Europe are like the same, but also different. Ethan, what are the implications of this shift on democratic societies? Is there a rise of populism in Europe?
So that's a very interesting question. And I want to just quickly respond to some things that Marta brought up, which is that my findings are for a kind of cross-sectional, cross-national analysis, which means certain cases will certainly not fit the exact trends. What I'm trying to do here is look at, like, if you look at all parties across Europe and kind of look for a general trend, what do things look like? And as a reminder, what I found is that in places with more asylum applications, center-right parties were more likely to adopt restrictive positions on immigration. Now, you asked, what are the implications of this finding kind of for democratic norms? This is a great question. And my kind of interpretation of it is that this is somewhat problematic and troubling from a democratic standpoint. If we find that kind of in increasingly diversifying societies, some parties are more likely to adopt kind of restrictive or hostile stances. Because what that means to me is that we have a situation in which parties are becoming increasingly hostile, populations of new migrants are growing, and that means more tension and the potential to kind of deny these migrants fundamental liberal rights. So that to me is very troubling. And I think one of the large challenges for politics today is to try to guarantee every person's fundamental individual rights, while also being able to express different political opinions and represent those opinions. What I will say, though, is that I find it a somewhat good sign that when you look at all the parties, so not just like if you look at parties that are not center-right parties, I did not find that relationship, which I think is kind of from a normative standpoint better, because it doesn't mean that parties become hostile in places with more kind of new migrants. You also asked about how is this kind of connected to the issue of populism? And I think that's a really interesting question. As Marta brought up at the beginning, she gave a really nice kind of overview of the populist radical right. And we haven't fully gotten into that yet, but we can think about like what are populist positions. Generally, we think of populism as kind of like creating two homogenous groups in society, kind of the pure people and a corrupt elite. And I think the issue of immigration connects directly to this, because when parties kind of adopt more restrictive positions, they're saying, we are here to protect like native people against outsiders. So very much fitting into this populist framework. And I think if we think about what do these findings mean for the rise of populism, it's one reason why kind of some extreme immigration positions are being adopted by more mainstream parties. So if we take my findings seriously, we have kind of a better understanding of how some positions that would be pretty like clearly populist positions, especially kind of populist radical right positions, are becoming adopted by some mainstream parties.
Thank you very much for your explanation, Ethan. Marta, would you say that similar processes of phenomena can be observed in Central Eastern Europe, or are there current or historical differences?
I would say there are certain similarities and there are certain differences when it comes to populism in East and the West, more or less. Let's put it this way. I would say the biggest difference is, I think, like before I start explaining, I need to kind of make a small detour into theory of populism, which is also another million-dollar question. What is populism? Let's put it aside for now, put a pin on that. However, there is one big differentiation what populism can be. One is populism is a type of ideology. It's like a political, like a set of political positions. And the other approach is populism is a tool, it's a way of doing politics. So sometimes it's being described as the hard and soft populism. And when it comes to Central Eastern Europe, the soft populism, so the way of doing politics in a populist way, is way more widespread. That is the case in Western Europe, or in the US for that matter as well. So what we see is we already have some sort of salience or satiation effects, because populist is more or less the way of doing politics in many of the countries here. So the problem we have in the countries that only became democratic after 1989 is that the democratic system in there is very often quite shallow. So it's mostly a historical reason, because after that, most of the countries decided that it's the historical point that they need to join NATO, they need to join the European Union, and that was like the big goal, the two big goals. So a lot of values, a lot of solutions, a lot of laws has to be adapted in order to be allowed into the club, so to say. And there was simply no time for like making sure that also people are taking in the values, the norms, and they start to hold society dear. So in a way, everybody was visibling the structure and nobody focused on building the demos. And in a way, we see consequences in that, because the way the democratic systems work there, as I already said, shallow. So what we see is not necessarily that they are weaker, like they are weaker, like because the systems are weaker, but they're not worse in the sense that they are not perfect democracies. It's more like the global processes that we see, like the democratic backsliding, authoritarian tendencies that are actually observable globally, can be observed in Central Eastern Europe a bit faster because the system is simply more shallow, so everything that is moving in becomes visible there faster.
Thank you very much for the information for Central Eastern Europe and how where the historical differences with the rest of Europe are developing on this case. This far, we've been talking about the issue of immigration as well as political parties. We also know that both of you are interested in right-wing populist parties. Would you mind defining what this group of parties is and explain it a little bit further, how their interests and success are connected to the issue of immigration?
Yeah, so this is a great question, and there's lots to go off of here. So I want to just start by kind of defining populism, and especially defining right-wing populism. And Marta has already given us some kind of things to chew on. So I'll just say that usually when I think of populism, I kind of work from the ideational definition, which is from Cass Muda and others. But so that to me is or not to me, but kind of how it's been defined is as, and I'm paraphrasing here, as like a thin-centered ideology that's splitting society into two kind of homogenous groups of people. So you have the pure people, as I mentioned earlier, and a corrupt elite. And then subsequently, the goal of politics is to carry out the will of the pure people. So there's a couple things to kind of dissect from that definition. So the first is that this is an ideology. This is kind of a way of seeing the world and a way of thinking about politics, but it is kind of a thin ideology, which means it's not enough on its own. It is usually kind of attached to some other ideology. So what we see with the populist radical right is that this ideology is attached to nationalism or nativism, which is kind of the idea that the state should be inhabited only by members of the national community. So then, like with that in mind, we're thinking about populist radical right parties as parties that are combining nationalism and populism. And what that means is that when you are defining who the pure people are, so who is it that a political party should represent, you're kind of defining that on a national basis. So the pure people are people who are like of the same nationality as me, which means that immigrants coming in are kind of fundamentally outside of that group. Now, different parties, and we'll get into this, like are kind of more willing to allow people into that national club at different points. But fundamentally, populist radical right parties have this issue with national outsiders, as well as kind of the populist dimension, which would be corrupt elite. And I'm doing air quotes here, which you can't see on a podcast. But the corrupt elite would be people who are kind of advocating to allow more outsiders into the nation. So as a kind of definition, this was a rambling way of saying these are parties that are kind of trying to split society into specific groups and only defend one group, which would be like this national community, who's kind of like an imagined community for them.
Thank you very much. Marta, do you want to add something or approach the issue from a different angle?
I mean, in general, there's a quite nice overview of what is populist. If I were to add something, I also like the definition by Jan van der Muller, who actually, it's basically like the same thing, but from a different perspective. What he's basically saying is populism is the rejection of plurality. So this is like the one true people, the one true leader, the one true will of the people, and so on. So this kind of a plurality, like different groups that are seen as equal or like divide, like unite in diversity approaches and so on. This is something that right-wing populists do not like at all.
Thank you too very much for your insights. Now we are in Germany, and so my next question will be about Germany. On the basis of our discussion, how would you two explain the rise of the alternative for Germany in the recent polls?
So I can just give like a quick...
Okay.
So I am not an expert on German politics, but based on our discussion that we've been having so far, I think like we can clearly connect the success of the AfD to migration, right? It is like one of their most important issues. Their voters are citing it that way. And it fits directly into this definition of right-wing populism that we've been working on, which is to say that this is a party that kind of puts their appeal on the idea that there are outsiders who like are entering the country who are not members of this pure people, like this national group, and that there are like corrupt elite who are kind of supporting this cause. So I think that we have kind of antagonisms on both horizontal and vertical dimensions, which is to say this party kind of pushes forward the idea that like there are other people in society who should not be part of the nation, and the elites are failing us because they're kind of supporting this project. So that would be like the kind of message that has, I think, attracted a lot of people to the party.
Thank you very much. Marta?
I actually don't think that this is something that we should worry about yet, because a single survey or two surveys means nothing if they do not become a trend. And this is just a recent development. So basically what you explain is, for me, would be more like, why do we have Alternative for Germany in Germany? So basically the rationale for existence of this party.
Yeah.
But it doesn't really explain the recent jump in support rates. And for me, like, first, we don't know if it's just a fluke or if it's a trend. If it's a trend, then we need to go into the field, do some studies, and actually find out what is the reason. If not, then it's more like a litmus test of the condition of the political scene in Germany. Because I think it is also important to remember that the populist right parties do not exist in a vacuum. They always exist in a broader context of a political spectrum in a given country. And they are quite often quite reactive because they are, as they position themselves as the parties against the corrupted elites, usually the corrupted elites, like the other political parties, are included in the other corrupted elites, which means they are reactive to whatever the corrupted elites, in quotation marks, are coming up with, which means the recent rise of AfD in Germany might be explained by whatever the other parties are doing or not doing that is being seen as something negative by the voters. And my suggestion would be that it has something to do with two things. One thing is the conflicts in the current coalition that doesn't look like they know what they are doing. And let's put it that way. SPD is not acting as the main coalition partner that is actually, like, should be the adult in the room. And the two smaller parties are bickering with one another, and nobody's controlling the house. And the second element will be the main opposition party, which is the Christian Democrats, that are also not doing, according to the voters, I would say, are not doing the job of being an opposition party well. Which means the voters are unhappy with the coalition, unhappy with the opposition, so we look for somebody else. And that would be my guess.
Do you want to say something to Martha's statement?
Yeah, I think that she brings up a really good point. And oftentimes, like, if you look in a kind of cross-national perspective, we see more support for the populist radical right parties when kind of mainstream parties are struggling or kind of have some crisis of legitimacy or are perceived as less competent. So I think the point that Marta raises about, like, what are perceptions of the current government and what are perceptions of the current kind of strength of the coalition are directly on point, which is that if more people believe that mainstream elites are failing them, they're more likely to kind of turn to other parties.
Thank you very much. If you want to, you now have both the chance to summarize your key arguments in 5 sentences each.
If I was to, like, summarize the main point I'm making, I would first say, first, populism and right-wing populism are here to stay, so we should, like, accept it as part of the political reality. Second, this is actually a quite fruitful point of doing research, which means we'll not be running out of jobs. But also, there are a lot of things also from the social perspective on why does the political spectrum differentiate so much, and why do we have a need for even more and even different types of right-wing parties, right-wing movements, and so on. So this is also kind of a, it's an indicator of something deeper happening in the society, and we will not understand the whole thing fully without also looking on the social element. And also, like, democratic system is also something that is not a given, and it is something that has to be taken care of. And I will quote one of my favorite quotes is by Jacek Kurin, who is one of the solidarity, the fathers of the solidarity movement in Poland, who said that democracy is a system that guarantees that we'll not be governed better as we deserve it.
So a few things. I would say from where our conversation started, and one thing that Marta brings up is that we actually see a lot of stability in politics. So if we can think back to earlier in this podcast, I was talking about my findings with regard to party position change. And I found that for the most part, parties did not shift more to the right or left throughout the so-called refugee crisis. How does that connect to Marta's point, which is that, like, if we think about populist radical right parties, they are more or less here to stay. These are things, like, I think one thing that I would take from this conversation is that there's actually a lot of stability in politics, even though we're talking about why kind of certain parties might change positions or populist radical right parties may have a spike in the polls. A lot of this is kind of small noise in a big picture that has remained at least somewhat consistent over the last 5-10 years, which is not to say there aren't quite a bit of changes, but that, like, as Marta said, these are just kind of features of political systems. I think our conversation on, like, understanding what populist radical right ideology is very important for trying to make sense of current politics in Germany and elsewhere. When we think about why certain political parties would either do the things they do or find the success or failure that they kind of run into, a lot of it does come down to, like, what are the messages that these parties are putting forward and what are their ideologies? And I think in this way, this is how we can kind of start to make sense of why a party would jump in the polls or why it may be struggling.
Thank you too very much for participating in this podcast.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
You're welcome. And I also hope you like this podcast. Thank you very much for your interest and your attention. If you want to view and also hear more from Medium, please hit the bell and also click on the following button, or by Spotify, only on the following button.